Call this meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. Okay. All right, we're going to move on to House File 1493, Representative Cornish. Yes. Do we have someone on the committee willing to move House File 1493? Oh, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion. So, Representative Cornish, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, as much as I detest reading my introduction, I have to boogie to my conference committee right after this and haven't a lot of time to memorize it all. This is a bill authored by me, House File 1493, and at first glance, it appears about liquor regulation, but it's really about fundamental public safety. Minnesota is the only state in the country which there is an active trade in gray markets distilled spirits. We're the only one of two states that does not have a law or regulation prohibiting gray market liquor. In Minnesota, we prevent gray market beer and wine, but not spirits. There are many fundamental food safety laws at the state and federal level that protect consumers from unsafe products. This primary source law protects consumers of beverage alcohol from unsafe products. However, until we reinstate the distilled spirits law into this law, like 48 other states have already done, we'll have a loophole remaining in the law. The absence of distilled spirits from our state's so-called primary source law is a loophole which is long overdue to be closed. And with that, I have to get to my conference committee over in the Senate and would turn it over to Mr. Hansen for a presentation.
Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. For the record, I'm Tom Hansen. I'm here today representing the Distilled Spirits Council of the United States. I want to remind you that Minnesota does have a primary source law right now for beer and wine, and that requires wholesalers to buy the product directly from the manufacturer. That's why it's called primary source. The Minnesota law for beer and wine has existed for about 30 years. We had it for a short time for distilled spirits, but we do not at the moment, and that's why we're here today. As Representative Cornish said, 48 other states have primary source for distilled spirits. Only Minnesota and Delaware do not. 48 other states, including states that we all the time around here like to compare ourselves to, that we like to think that we're doing better than, like Louisiana and Mississippi have primary source laws for distilled spirits and arguably have closed the loophole for this product. The reason for primary source is to protect the health and safety of consumers by ensuring that only genuine alcohol products are sold to consumers. Since 9/11, federal and state laws have been changed to ensure greater food safety, including the traceability of products from farmers' fields to the processing plant, to the wholesaler, to the retail store, to the family table. And that has happened with a lot of products. Because the 21st Amendment repealing prohibition gave the states the power to regulate alcohol, each state needs to deal with the food safety aspects of alcohol. The primary source law is designed to ensure the traceability of alcohol directly from the manufacturer to the wholesaler to the retailer to the consumer. Because distilled spirits were removed from Minnesota's primary source law in the 1990s, we have a major consumer protection weakness in our food safety laws. Primary source aids in consumer protection against counterfeit product, against legitimate product which may be subject to recall or has been tainted, and to ensure tax compliance. And Mr. Chairman and members, in your packet you have a map that shows you all the states that have primary source for distilled spirits. Includes, you'll notice, Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota. So the states around us have this law as well. With that, I'll turn it over to my counterpart here.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time. My name is Dale Sandrowski. I'm Vice President for Distilled Spirits Council of the U.S. DISCUS is what we're commonly referred to. We're the trade association that represents producers and marketers of distilled spirits in the U.S., the brand owners for the United States. We're part of the three-tier system. We're the top of the three-tier system. We sell to the Minnesota wholesalers, all Minnesota wholesalers, who in turn sell to the Minnesota retailers and consumers. What I'd like to focus in on today a little bit is why we believe that this is a consumer protection issue and a health and safety issue, and why we believe that it's time for Minnesota to reinstate primary source for distilled spirits. You've got it for beer, you've got it for wine. Those are consumer protections. It works very well. It's time to reinstate it for distilled spirits. Let me be perfectly clear on this point. The United States is the safest part of the world for the consuming public, those Minnesota adult consumers who choose to consume beverage alcohol. It's the safest market in the world. Having said that, I need to bring your attention, that's in your packets, to the stories about the proliferation of counterfeit products that are happening around the world. This is not something that we take lightly. We're not talking about Gucci handbags. We're not talking about high-priced electronics or men's suits. We're talking about a consumable food product. The administration and Congress has put a high priority on traceability of food products, and distilled spirits are a food product. It's a consumable product. It's incumbent upon us to be able to trace and pull off, should there ever be any instances of mislabeled product, tampering, intentional or unintentional, or something wrong with the product. We've provided you with some articles about products that have come off the marketplace because there was glass and bottles, chips and bottles that they discovered. We need to be able to pull that off the market shelves 24 to 36 hours. There's two loopholes in the system currently, as Mr. Hansen identified, Delaware and Minnesota. We've spoken with the liquor commissioner from Delaware recently, and he has assured us that, number one, because of the size of the marketplace, probably about the size of Minneapolis-St. Paul, that there has been no gray market activity in his state, at least for the last 10 years that he's aware of, that as long as he's been commissioner. And number two, that if it were happening, he felt that he had enough regulatory authority that they could put an end to that situation. So what we're really talking about is the fact that there's one last loophole in the safety net for beverage alcohol, and that's in Minnesota, for primary source. Again, a proliferation of serious counterfeit issues that have come up around the world. And it started out in Eastern Europe, but as your color-coded map indicates, it's progressed around the world. It's as close as Latin America, it's as close as Mexico. Let me stress, we do not believe that there is an issue here in Minnesota at this juncture. We just want to make sure that Minnesota consumers have that full confidence when that loophole is closed, and that no gray market products are coming in. Let me address just briefly something that you might hear a little bit later, and something that I had looked up previously as an argument suggesting that prices are going to be kept low because of gray market activity, and that we've looked at the surrounding states' market pricing. You're on a par. There are some prices higher, some prices lower. It all depends on the marketplace and the activity going on in that marketplace. Secondly, you might hear that, oh, in Europe it's a lot cheaper for products. That would be like comparing apples to watermelons. Completely different market scenario. We have a three-tier system in this country. It's by design. Each state is a state-based regulatory system. So that's not even a consideration for comparison. Lastly, my members spend millions of dollars on the brand reputation, building consumer confidence, building up their brands. The wholesalers that we sell to who operate on a level playing field, are willing to compete on a level playing field, invest millions of dollars in ensuring that the consumer gets the true product, not a like product, but a true product that is handled in accordance with the regulations that we fall under, the federal guidelines, the fact that it's stored in a proper manner, it's handled in a proper manner, and gets to the consumer in the freshest, most consumable taste that he is expecting. again, we don't anticipate any serious issues in the near future. We just want to protect and close that loophole and make the entire United States the safest place in the world. And let me close by saying just a little personal story. I know that there's been probably saying that nothing has happened. Nothing has happened in the last 20, 30 years that we're aware of. Well, when I was a young man and started out in this business over 30 years ago and came out of Schlitz Brewing Management classes, my first task was picking up thousands and thousands of cases of Schlitz beer. We had a product issue. 5 years, $1 billion in advertising and marketing and sales promotions, and we never got that brand back to where it was. Now, no one got sick from that product that I'm aware of at that time. But it has happened in the past. It can happen in the future, and this will help ensure that it doesn't happen by closing the last loophole. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I'm available for recall. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony. Mr. Hansen, do you have any other testifiers?
Yes, we do.
Can we have them come down at this time? Gentlemen, if you could, please state your names for the record, and please proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Ralph Strangis of the firm of Kaplan, Strangis & Kaplan, and we serve as counsel to the Minnesota Wine and Spirits Wholesale Association. And I'm here on behalf of the association to support inclusion of distilled spirits in the primary source law. Our members, who represent over 90% of the market, are supporting this legislation for one reason, and that is the integrity of the product. It's critically important to them in an area like alcohol that they be mindful of and sensitive to not only what has happened but what could happen and the impact of that on businesses that have been built up over many, many years. In terms of the issue of competition and how this might affect competition, Minnesota already has robust competition at the wholesale level, and that competition has been even strengthened further with the admission of Southern Wine and Spirits to our association and their involvement in the Minnesota market. They are the largest national distributor of distilled spirits, and they are now a member of the association and also support this legislation. In terms of the issue of competition, we already have robust competition. Clearly, there are 48 other states. Some of them have fewer distributors and larger populations, and there is no evidence that in those states that the competition or the retail prices or the effect on restaurants, bars, and others who purchase distilled spirits has been affected by the existence of primary source laws. Certainly we have our neighboring states to look to, and we have wine, which is already subject to the primary source law, as another example that robust competition can and does exist even with primary source in place. It's true that there's no suggestion that there is a large effect on the gray market or product being brought in that's adulterated, but most of the companies in this business, the wholesalers, are family businesses. They have been in business for, in some instances, beyond my career. I represented several of them back 50 years ago when I started practicing law. These are companies that are vitally interested in their reputations, their integrity. They have built their businesses. Clearly there have been changes since the distilled spirits came out of the law in 1991. Both there have been changes in the dynamics of the market. There have been changes in the law, as was previously testified to, in terms of further Food and Drug Administration laws and others. And so at this point in time, those members in my association represent 90% of the market, strongly support the inclusion of distilled spirits in primary source law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strangis. Mr. Georgikis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I want to just supplement the previous testifier's testimony with just a few additional points. First, I want to say that it is rare that wholesalers and manufacturers often agree on issues relating to liquor regulation, but this is an issue where, in fact, that is the case. And the reason that the distillers and the Wholesalers Association are in support of reinstating distilled spirits into the primary source statute is because of exactly the point that Mr. Sandrowski identified earlier, which is the proliferation of counterfeit alcohol in recent years. There was a legislative study conducted 15 years ago. In fact, Mr. McCormick was a co-author of that study when he was working for the other body, which examined this issue after there was some discussion after 1991's removal of distilled spirits from the statute. And at that time, the staff report, and I think the Alcohol and Gaming Enforcement Division at the Department of Public Safety had determined that there was no documentable cases of counterfeit or adulterated product in the Minnesota marketplace. As Mr. Sandrowski said, we are fortunate that in the United States we have a very safe market, and that here in Minnesota we have not had documented cases. But Mr. Sherman and members, if you look at the news clips that are appended to this map, all of them date from the last roughly 12 to 18 months. This is just a small sample of the stories from around the globe, in Europe, in Asia, in South and Central America, as close to the United States as Mexico, where there are substantial cases and very sophisticated counterfeit operations being conducted, to the point that the sort of holographic labels that are attached to bottles of what purport to be various distilled spirits are to even sophisticated consumers and those in the industry indistinguishable from the genuine product. Now, no one's suggesting today that counterfeit product is entering into Minnesota through any gray market operations that exist today, but we know that that possibility is very real in the future. We know that there are various countries like the United Kingdom that have a rampant surplus of counterfeit product. In fact, according to British police authorities, up to one quarter of all the retail establishments may have counterfeit product on their shelves. We know this is a problem, and as the previous witnesses indicated, we want to make sure that the very basic the fabric of food safety laws are extended in this state. Minnesota is an outlier. We've seen at both the federal and state level increased efforts to try to ensure that there is traceability of product from, whether it's from the farmers fields all the way to consumers' tables, and the same with alcohol. There are very specific reasons why distilled spirits were removed from the statute in 1991. Those circumstances do not exist today, and we think that it is high time for us to close this loophole, to add distilled spirits to wine and beer as we've had in the statute for the last 30 years. And Mr. Chairman, I know that I and the other witnesses would be happy to stand for any questions, now or later.
Thank you, Mr. Georgikis. First question on the list is Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Georgikis. I'd just be curious if, with your bill, would only the wealthiest Minnesotans, maybe the ones that were in suites at a football stadium, would they be only the ones able to purchase your safe alcohol, or would everyone in Minnesota be able to purchase safe alcohol?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lilly, I think the wholesalers, by and large, have stayed out of the fight relating to the Gopher football stadium.
But your intent would be to have everybody have safe distilled spirits.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lilly, I think all Minnesotans deserve to have safe food and safe alcoholic beverages.
Thank you for your... Thank you.
Thank you, Representative
chicken.
Lilly.
Chicken.
Any other questions from members for these testifiers? Seeing none, looks like we have several on the list to testify in opposition to the bill. As they are making their way to the table, Representative Stensrud, will you please... I'm sorry. Representative Doubt, I'm told you have reviewed the minutes.
Yes, I have, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move the that we accept the minutes with one little oral amendment. Representative Kiefer and Representative Stensrud actually, I think, should have been marked as excused instead of present.
Any discussion to the motion with that small amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are approved as amended. Mr. Ines.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines, and I'm here on behalf of Bellboy Wine and Spirits to voice our strong opposition to the imposition of a primary source law in Minnesota. And I chafe a little bit at the representation that this is a loophole. We have not had a primary source law in Minnesota relative to distilled spirits for 20 years. There was an attempt in 1995 to impose a primary source law. That attempt failed in the legislature. The legislature made a conscious and rational decision not to impose a primary source law in Minnesota. In 1995, they also commissioned a study to do an extensive, some research and just revisit the primary arguments for imposing a primary source law in Minnesota. And I've handed out the executive summary. It's this document right here that was done by nonpartisan legislative staff. It was commissioned in 1995 and issued in 1996. And I think it's a very well-researched report. It's withstood the test of time. And I think I'd just like to really briefly walk through on the back page. It's double I. Kind of what they concluded in 1996. And I think if you fast forward to 15 years later, nothing has materially changed in the landscape from 1995-96. If you look at product purity and integrity, you heard that we got to impose a primary source law to ensure product purity and integrity. In 1996, the conclusion was no examples of product contamination or compromised product integrity were brought forward. Today, no examples of product integrity or anybody being harmed, any Minnesota consumer being harmed, any customer being harmed. 15 years later, nothing has changed from that finding. Tax evasion. State revenue officials respond that they have adequate controls in place to prevent tax evasion and that there's no reason to believe that any significant evasion is going on. I spent the last 4 years at the Department of Revenue. I can speak unequivocally and without hesitation, there is no tax evasion problem with this tax type. It is probably one of the highest compliant taxes we have in the state of Minnesota. The reason that is, it's a felony in Minnesota to sell untaxed liquor. There is not an evasion problem. I've talked to the Department of Revenue recently. They reaffirmed the finding back in 1996. Tax compliance is not an issue relative to the current system. The other issue we hear about is smuggling. If you look at finding number four, the absence of a primary source law could, in some instances, conceivably contribute to smuggling. Well, there was nothing but anecdotal evidence back in 1995, and there has been no tangible examples, no documented examples of there being smuggling being a problem in Minnesota. If this truly was a public safety issue, the Department of Public Safety would be here supporting the bill. They are not here supporting the bill. If this was a public health issue, the Department of Public Health, Minnesota Department of Public Health, would be here supporting this bill. This is really a solution looking for a problem. We've had 20 years of experience. That 20 years shows a clean record. Even the testifiers have acknowledged there's no evidence in Minnesota of any, tainted gray market product reaching the marketplace. We have retailers who are opposed to imposition of primary source. They have no examples of any contaminated product or Minnesota consumers being adversely impacted. This really is a solution looking for a problem. The real reason for imposition of a primary source law isn't about public safety. It isn't about public health. It's about market share. It's about that the big distributors wanting to fence out the smaller players in the marketplace. That's what this is about. The public health is merely really a red herring relative to this issue. And I'd like to, if I'd be happy to answer any questions. I'd like to hand it off to Mr. Gewald here. He is the president of Bellboy Wine and Spirits, and he can speak very informatively about his business and the adverse impact that this law would have on his employees and his business.
Thank you, Mr. Ines. Mr. Gewald, thank you for coming to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Chairman, fellow committee members, my name is David Gewald. I am owner of Bellboy Wholesale Liquor, located in Golden Valley, Minnesota. Bellboy has been a liquor and wine distributor for 33 years. Bellboy employs 60 people consisting of salespeople, truck drivers, warehouse workers, and additional office staff. Many of those people are here today. Over the past 33 years, Bellboy has paid over $100 million in Minnesota excise tax. Bellboy has been audited several times with absolutely no reports of short payment of taxes of any kind. I come to you today in opposition to the implementation of a primary source law in Minnesota. I also speak for Sunny Hill Distribution, who is also a distributor located in Hibbing, Minnesota. The lack of a primary source law in Minnesota has allowed Bellboy to legally source like products, like liquor products, from several markets in the United States, where prices for these products are greatly discounted in comparison to product offered for sale by our suppliers in Minnesota. Quite simply, I'd like to use the following analogy to explain. If you were in the market to purchase a new Chevrolet and you found a similar car in Des Moines, Iowa at a $1,900 discount, you are allowed to buy that car and save the money. That is the same situation that we're talking about here. Our suppliers, represented by Discus today, charge Minnesota wholesalers significantly high FOB prices than those wholesalers in major U.S. markets like New York, California, Florida, etc. Bellboy has been savvy enough to realize this and therefore has taken advantage of these differences and as a result have brought cheaper prices to Minnesota retailers and thus the Minnesota consumer. The implementation of a primary source law would restrict one from sourcing such savings. It would restrict free competition, it would restrict the integrity of a free market. This is the real reason why those who favor a primary source law are here today. As I said prior, I have been in the liquor business for 33 years. I have never heard of tainted or counterfeit products in our Minnesota market. This is a fact. You can ask any Minnesota retailer, and he would say the same thing. There is no such problem. Implementation of a primary source law would limit competition, and such a law would hurt my business significantly. I would be forced to cut numerous jobs, and this is not good for anyone except for my competitors who see this as an opportunity to restrict competition. Despite years and years and years of discriminatory actions by the large outstate suppliers, Bellboy has been able to continue to bring Minnesota competitive pricing through legal channels due to the lack of a primary source law. There has been absolutely no reports of counterfeit or tainted products in Minnesota. We are here today because my much larger competitors want to create this law for financial gains. Don't be fooled by their concerns. You have all been lobbied a great deal. I wonder why. We at Bellboy, along with retailers across Minnesota, know what the real facts are. I would like to share an interesting situation that has come up in the past 24 hours. A major retailer who wished to testify today in opposition to the primary source was threatened by my competition and thus is not here today. He was told that his testimony would result in financial repercussions. Enough said. This is indeed a controversial bill. Let this be known. I also like to speak about some of the testimony by Discus. A couple of issues. Number one, they talk about that there is a primary source law in Minnesota for beer and wine and not liquor. The real reason for that is because of the nature of the product. Wine is perishable, it's fragile, it goes bad. There needs to be more control. I agree with that. Likewise, beer is a similar product to wine and that it's perishable, it is affected by heat, is affected by cold. There has to be more control over that. If you have a bottle of whiskey at home, it'll sit in your cupboard, it'll be good for 30, 40 years. The stuff doesn't go bad. That's a good thing about our product line that we carry. Discus also refers to that in 48 states there's a primary source law. He fails to tell you that in the other 48 states there are exclusive arrangements between suppliers and wholesalers. What I mean by that is that in all other states, there is a single wholesaler that all he carries exclusively certain products. In the state of Minnesota and in the state of Oklahoma, that is not true. So now you have Minnesota with no primary source law and no exclusive brands. It runs hand in hand. Discus also mentioned traceability. I suggest that the next time you go to a liquor store, you look at a liquor box and you'll see markings on the boxes. And I wish I had brought one here today to show you. But these show lot numbers, dates that the product has been bottled, etc. And there is exact, they know where the product is coming from. Okay. If the product is brought, the product that is being brought from outside the state of Minnesota is coming from other wholesalers around the country. So the product is coming from the distillery. We have been bringing this product in for many years. We're bringing product in from the United States, from United States wholesalers and alike. Not once would we ever dream or think about bringing in a container of Chivas Regal or Cutty Sark from Algeria or Croatia or wherever. That's not in our interest. We're not interested in doing that. We're bringing in, and by law, we're allowed to bring in similar like product. That means the bottle of Jim Beam has the same UPC code, it has the same label, it's the same like product. Discus also says that prices in neighboring states are similar to the state of Minnesota. He fails to say that our excise taxes in Minnesota are among the highest in the country, and our therefore, our wholesalers are working on small margins, and therefore, we are in par with the rest of the other states because our state taxes are high. Mr. Strangis refers to the Wholesalers Association saying that they are for a primary source law. I was at the meeting on March 16th where this discussion, there was no discussion on the bill, but the discussion was had between four major large wholesalers, myself, who we actually do about 5 to 6% of the market, along with Sunny Hill Distributing in Minnesota and in Hibbing, Minnesota, that does maybe 1% of the business, but he is a small wholesaler like ourselves. There was no discussion at the meeting to discuss the issue. It seemed like they had their own agenda. There was a vote taken. The large wholesalers teamed up against the small wholesalers 4-2. It was an issue on the agenda. It was the last issue on our agenda. Everybody rushed out of the meeting, and that is the situation that we were left with. That is pretty much my testimony here, and I am open for any questions by anybody here.
Thank you, Mr. Jewell, for your testimony. You. Members, any questions for either of these testifiers? Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Jewell, for your testimony. And thank you, Mr. Sullivan, for getting out of the way. The two quick questions. One is, can you bring in product? You said you don't, but can you bring in product from abroad?
Mr. Jewell.
We don't. We don't do that. Can you? I assume you can. I'm not sure. It's not in my best interest to bring product from
yeah, you
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jewell, I think you made that point clear. I wasn't clear on whether it could happen. And I see the other folks brought in maps and had red countries or something, but I honestly just wasn't clear on whether that was possible. The second thing is, to the extent that you do bring in product from outside of Minnesota, what, and I should probably know the answer to this, I've been around these liquor bills for a long time, but to what degree is it under the control, the inspection, oversight of Minnesota authorities?
Mr. Jewell.
Representative, we've been bringing in product from the primary source for many years, and we still continue to do that. We have records at our office like the other wholesalers have. We have to keep strict records for tax reasons. We have receiving reports for every load of liquor that comes into our building, and we treat product that is purchased either from another wholesaler in this state or another wholesaler in another state, we treat that similarly. It's a receiving report stating number of gallons, number of cases, the product. It's public knowledge, and that's what we do. We just treat it like it's another supplier.
Just Representative Atkins.
I think it's just a small follow-up. In the last year, how much of the product that has come in from, I don't want to say abroad, outside of Minnesota, from some other outside of Minnesota source, how much has been inspected, tested, reviewed in any way by Minnesota authorities?
Mr. Gewald.
Absolutely zero, but no product that's been brought in from the primary source has ever been reviewed by any other people.
Representative Atkins.
And my only point, Mr. Chair, I think you both make an eloquent argument about that there haven't been cases of painted product, and you talk about, you know, that there isn't smuggling. You make the point it's an economic argument. You've made that very clear to me. The challenge is to the extent that there is tainted product, can it come into Minnesota and remain tainted and cause problems here? And your point is that since the study that Mr. McCormick did when he was, confused in the Senate, actually, I don't think he was confused in the Senate. He finally wised up and came over to the House. But that there haven't been enough, that there haven't been an impetus to change the law. My concern, though, is to the extent that those issues arise, are there adequate controls to address them under current law, or should we change it so that we don't have those threats at all?
It's Mr. Dryness, Mr. Gewald.
Excuse me, Mr. Representative. If the system's not broken, why are we discussing these things? It's just not an issue, okay? The last thing we want to, or the other wholesalers, is want to bring in tainted product or gray market product in order to save $5 a case. Our customer doesn't want it. The consumer doesn't want it. Why are we even interested in doing something like that? I think there's also a lot of safeguards by the federal government. Before a container of product is shipped to the United States, there is prior notice that has to be given. If there is a load, say, of Chivas Regal coming from Algeria, that's going to cause a red flag at the federal level, and it would be stopped then. I don't think any safeguards revolving around a primary source law in Minnesota is going to stop that load of Chivas Regal from coming into the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you please tell me, and if I missed it, I'm sorry, who do you sell to then?
I am a liquor and wine distributor.
Right.
I have a warehouse. Okay. Right. I sell to liquor stores, restaurants, and bars who have Minnesota licenses, and I sell to those three groups in the state of Minnesota. Okay.
Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just skimming these articles, and I was just curious because it says in this article that most illegally produced alcohol doesn't get into the stores, but rather to pubs, clubs, and restaurants. So I was just wondering if you distributed to restaurants and bars.
Anybody who has
Mr. Gewald.
I'm sorry, anybody who has a license.
Okay.
Representative Dietrich, does that answer your questions?
Yes, thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gewalt, why, we have it on wine, the primary source. Why wouldn't we have this on distilled spirits? You talked about that, yes, wine can spoil, but I think that's not the issue here. This is a concern about public safety and making sure that the product has the integrity. Can you tell me why would we have it on wine but not distilled spirits?
Mr. Gewalt.
Thank you. That's a very difficult question. I can only refer back to that because of, again, it's just the nature. It's the nature of the product. It's wine is there's a threat if wine is not stored correctly, it's going to spoil. If beer has a shelf life, there has to be more control. You can't afford to have old beer being brought in from another state. You can't afford to have old brown Chardonnay coming from another state. You have to have the wholesalers accountable for what they're selling, and that is the reason why there's no primary source. A bottle, again, as I said before, a bottle of whiskey will stay forever. Maybe a Bailey's Irish Cream, you get a little bit of curdle there on an Irish cream, and we get a few bottles off that, but that's all the situations that we confront on a daily basis.
Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Gewald, but that doesn't kind of really get at the issue of it being counterfeit and trying to track that at all. So why would that be different for wine and not the same for the distilled spirits?
I think there was no primary source law in Minnesota originally because it tied into the Coleman Act of 1977. And in the Coleman Act of 1977, prior to 1977, there was exclusivity from the wholesale to the from the supplier to the wholesaler. Again, meaning that one wholesaler had the rights to sell Absolut, okay? Or at that time, a Windsor Canadian or a Christian Brothers brandy, whatever the brand was. I think in the spirit of the law, Mr. Coleman wanted to break open the monopoly that had existed in Minnesota. And by breaking over the monopoly, he wanted to give the wholesalers the freedom and the flexibility to purchase product where they find the cheapest price for the state of Minnesota.
Chairman, real quick.
Mr. Innes.
Chairman, Representative Anderson. I think your point is very well taken. I think what we do have is 20 years of experience. I mean, it's not as if we've had a primary source law for a short period of time. We have a beta test of 20 years. And in that two decades, we can point to not one in 20 years, tangible example of product being tainted, consumer being harmed. If we were to regulate every time there was a hypothetical harm out there, enhanced regulation, or if we were to clamp down on open and robust competition, every time there was a hypothetical kind of boogeyman kind of argument out there, we could pass a lot of laws around here and regulate very heavily. So I just think we've beta tested this thing for 20 years. There's no evidence at all of any harm being done. The marketplace seems to be working well. We'd also like to introduce, I know you have limited time here, we'd like to introduce a couple retailers who would like to testify as well, Chairman.
Yes, if they could, please come forward at this time, and please keep your comments brief as we are ending the end of our time on this topic.
Thank you.
Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I'm Quinn Cheney, representing the Solomon Strategies Group, which is a local lobbying and advocacy firm. I'm here today on behalf of my client, the Minnesota Wine and Spirits Group, which includes some of the leading retail liquor stores in Minnesota. My clients are strongly opposed to this legislation. Minnesota consumers currently benefit from the ability of local liquor stores to buy distilled spirits from the most cost-effective sources available. Passage of this bill would prohibit that. It would raise wholesale prices, costs that local liquor stores have to pass on to their customers. My clients feel that this bill would restrict free market access to liquor and would likely result in increased costs for their consumers.
Thank you, Ms. Cheney. Sir, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Tim Bevins, and I own Tonka Bottle Shop in Minnetonka for 34 years. Chairman and committee members, I'm here today to voice my opposition to the primary source law in Minnesota. I can honestly say that in all my years of business, I've never had any situation that I've received or sold tainted or counterfeit product. I don't see this as a problem. As a retailer, I appreciate the existing free and competitive market. A primary source bill would threaten the existing market, in turn hurt my business and my customers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bevins. Members, any questions at all for the testifiers? Seeing none?
Thank you, Chairman.
Excellent. Thank you very much. At this point in time, seeing no further questions, I will make the motion that we lay over House File 1493 for possible inclusion in the Liquor Omnibus Bill. Next on the agenda is House File 1395, Representative Loon. Representative Loon, to your bill, House File 1395. And folks, if we could please take the conversations outside and exit quietly, we have a couple of important issues to get to here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes. Would you like to me to describe the bill first or move the delete all amendment, Mr. Chair?
Why don't we move to the delete all, since that's the shape that you would like the bill in.
I think there's a copy in members' packets. If anyone doesn't have it, DE1. It's a DE1.
Members, does everyone have the DE1 for House File 1399? It appears that we have it. You may proceed, Representative Loon.
Well, I'll just briefly describe the DE1 amendment. This makes substantial changes to the bill as introduced, and so just walking through it, basically it deletes everything except Section 1, and then there are two new sections in the bill. One would increase the weekly wage loss amount from $250 to $500 a week, and the second would increase the death benefit from $2,000 to $5,000.
Members, any questions before we adopt the DE1 to put it in the shape that the author would like? Seeing none, all in favor of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Loon, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll try not to be too long today, and I think you're going to hear from both the insurance representative and folks from the chiropractors today, and to let members know it is my intention to ask that this bill be laid over as opposed to vote, and you'll hear a little bit more about that in a bit. But I do think it's important to lay out the framework of what this bill's about. Members, I'm presenting House File 1395 to address a problem that really impacts consumers in Minnesota with regard to the price of their auto insurance, and then the medical coverage that's involved in that coverage for that all drivers are required to carry. It's called Personal Injury Protection, or PIP, and it was enacted in 1974 when Minnesota adopted our no-fault auto system. This coverage has no cost containment in it whatsoever for medical coverage, and consumers are increasingly forced to pay higher costs and premiums for excessive treatments because there are no cost controls. We don't have any other insurance system with regards to healthcare that does not have any cost containment tools. Workers' compensation recognizes that, and they have such provisions in it. Major medical, if you have health benefits, there are fee schedules, treatment parameters, negotiated discounts, and provider networks. Auto insurance in Minnesota are required to pay the RAC rate, so whatever is submitted. And that has caused some problems. There's been a few outliers, providers in the industry, and that seems to be continuing to grow. Our drivers, our consumers, are really the losers in this, who are required to pay more. Minnesota rates are higher than many of the states around us, and this problem will continue to get worse, in my opinion, unless we take some steps to address it. So my bill provides some changes to our no-fault laws to try to control some of those medical costs, and would namely bring a workers' compensation fee schedule into the treatment parameters, and that was similar to those changes that were made in 1992. Section 1 would require that the treatment of soft tissue injuries from auto accidents subject to the treatment standards and fees of the workers' comp system. This would cover chiropractors and physical therapists, and those are the providers doing most of the soft tissue treatment for auto injuries. Right now, 69% of all provider claim payments go to chiropractors and physical therapists, and this is a rapid growth area of claims payments, and that's why I'm focusing on that part of it. My proposal does not exclude any Minnesota chiropractor or physical therapist from treating any individual injured in an auto accident or from being paid a reasonable fee. As long as the provider can meet the care standards and the rules, the provider can continue to provide care for up to 12 weeks. I'm also proposing, as I explained earlier, that we enhance two of the coverages currently provided in auto insurance. That is an increase in the weekly wage loss from $250 to $500 a week, and also increasing the funeral expense coverage from $2,000 to $5,000. Members, I feel that this approach is a balanced and reasonable one. I know that there may be some who disagree with that who will be hearing from today. But I'm really hoping that this dialogue today will start some sincere negotiations and discussions among legislators and all stakeholders, the insurance industry, consumers, and the providers, the chiropractors as well, to try to reach some consensus on this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Members, any questions immediately for Representative Loon? Seeing none, Mr. Johnson, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you. Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, and I represent auto insurers that write a majority of the private passenger automobiles sold in Minnesota. And with Representative Loon's comments, Mr. Chairman, it's really just three kind of quick questions I'd like to flag, and I won't go through all the materials except for two pages in there. And first, in terms of three questions. Why are we here today with this bill? The second question, what does the amendment do? And then third, if it's passed, if this were passed in the law, what should you expect to happen in terms of the marketplace and consumers? And I think Representative Loon has done the background of why here today from our perspective. Our no-fault law was passed in 1974. It was effective in 1975. That was the era when many states were passing no-fault laws that reached the peak or the zenith of 24 states in the late 70s, and since that time, no-fault systems have been going away. And the reason they have been going away is that they're failing. They are not doing what the legislatures, when they adopted them, intended them to do. And frankly, neither is our system doing what it was intended to do. So I think the reason why we're here today advocating for 1395 and the Delete Everything Amendment is that it is simply not serving the consumers of Minnesota to provide really what was intended when this was passed in 1974. And just briefly, the no-fault system, and there's some misnomers about what it is. When no-fault laws were passed, there's two parts to them. A mandatory first-party medical coverage that consumers have to buy in their auto policies. And the second part is that language that specifically limits tort lawsuits for pain and suffering damages. So those are the two features of no-fault laws. And if the evaluation about whether no-fault laws are working, you look at those two features of the law. This bill deals with one of those features, the medical costs. And again, as Representative Loon has said, this is a system that has no medical cost controls. None. Nada. Zero. Nothing. And so that is not serving consumers well. Frankly, if we could control appropriate controls on some of the medical costs of the system, it would actually be a better value for consumers, because then it would likely ferret out some care that frankly is not serving any purpose, excessive, unnecessary care. So in terms of that's why we're here today, if the committee members would just turn to the last three pages of the handout that you have in front of you. I'm just going to just talk about two of the pages, one of them that says, if you'll turn to the last three, the third from the bottom, I'm sorry I didn't put page numbers on it, but you'll see a comparison of medical services utilization for soft tissue injury treatments. And this is just to document so that the committee members know, we just show the difference between no-fault auto the current work comp system, and then examples of what happens today in Minnesota in major medical. Those are the three major systems where there's some health care coverage. And we give you actual data from closed claims to show you that under the no-fault system, the PIP, the average number of chiropractor visits is 32. The second one is that under the work comp system, there's a 12-week limit. And again, this has been on the books in Minnesota since 1992, so we have a lot of experience under it. And under that 12-week, it's not a hard cutoff. There's an ability to continue care and treatment beyond that. And the major medical has got much more flexibility and ability of health insurers to specifically control and cap the treatment that's provided. And I just gave an example of currently approved policies in Minnesota market today where major medical insurers have an absolute, just a $500 cap on all manipulative therapy is just an example. The next slide, if you just briefly, I wanted to show the committee members specific examples of what happens today in Minnesota on reimbursement. So we listed CPT codes and showed what Medicare pays, obviously at the bottom rate. We show what the current work comp system pays, and that's set in state statute. There's no negotiation of rates under the work comp system. It's established under the law. And then the third one, we just show actual examples of the reimbursements, and no fault sits at the very top of the reimbursement rate. So with those two, then I think the second question, and the Representative Loon again has described the amendment in terms of what the amendment does, I think maybe I could just add what it doesn't do. Again, there's no negotiation of rates with providers, so it's decidedly different than the managed health care. There really are no networks in the system, so providers are not excluded from participating in the work comp system. And I think with that, Mr. Chairman and committee members, that in our mind is it's a reasonable approach to putting some constraints on the system. It's not excluding providers, and it's not the managed care in its full bore, if you will. It's limited. And we believe those are reasonable provisions. And the track record in Minnesota, I believe, is constructive on how the work comp law has worked for injured workers since 1992. And then the third question, Mr. Chairman and committee members, is what would you expect if it's passed? And that's a legitimate question, as I maybe had commented in an earlier committee. Given the nature of these reforms, the work comp system, there's not absolute cutoffs. The my comment to the committee is that whatever savings are going to happen in this bill, and there would be savings if this were enacted into law, there would be savings, that you as the legislators could and should expect those savings to absolutely be reflected, and they would need to be reflected in the rate filings that every auto insurer makes in the state. And it's significant. The no-fault PIP medical today constitutes about $500 million. That's about the pool of dollars. So if reforms reduce that by 50%, that'd be $250 million. That's about 10%. That's about a 10% cost impact on the system. So I'm not here to predict what they would do, because I don't think we'd be able to do that, to be honest with you, given the nature of the reforms. These are not harsh, you know, cutoffs. People have the ability to continue care and treatment. So I think it's those are the three questions, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'd be happy to stand for any questions anybody has.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. First questions come from Chairman Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things here. First of all, to Representative Loon, I know we're laying this over, so maybe this question's somewhat out of order, but it's never stopped me before. Has Chair Abler or Chair Gottwalt requested this bill since it has to do with health care and those issues?
Representative Loon.
Thank you for the question, Representative Davids. I have spoken with Chairman Abler. I have not spoken with Chairman Gottwald, but I've spoken with Chairman Abler fairly extensively. We did ask nonpartisan research to do an analysis of the bill with a delete all amendment. They don't see that it triggers a referral to his committee. However, because it's dealing with a health care issue, I've asked him to be involved in any discussions that go on to try to reach a consensus on this matter.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Loon. I have a little different view than my good friend Mr. Johnson here on this particular issue. I happen to believe that the no-fault law in Minnesota has worked quite well I don't know what some other states have had some problems. I think some have tried to repeal it, or I'm not sure what every state has done. But I think it's worked quite well for Minnesota. It is a very low-cost health care coverage available to everyone that has an auto policy. A question to Mr. Johnson. A couple questions. First of all, you said that there's no medical cost controls on no-fault. I was a couple years ago, I was with my E85 Suburban, and I stopped home with some snow had fallen over some ice, and I stepped out of my vehicle, and all of a sudden I was under it. And I had my Hard Rock Cafe jacket on. That kind of helps, you know, that leather jacket was helpful. That's the one that got stolen when my vehicle got broken into at Kellogg Square. $400 kind of hurt my feelings. So I went under, and, man, I hit hard. The next thing I know, I'm underneath my truck. I just hope the neighbors didn't see that. And so I went down the chiropractor. And he was able to get it. Since I was touching the truck, it's a no-fault claim because it was actually like an auto accident. And when you say that there's no medical cost controls, I was given so many visits by my insurance care, and that was it. And my chiropractor didn't think I was done, and I didn't think I was done because I knew I wasn't done because I was still hurting pretty good. And so how can you say there's no medical cost controls when my auto insurer said you're done?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative David, I'm glad you're doing well and you can recover from all of that.
Feel great.
Because
of my chiropractor.
Mr. Chairman, we're not going to be cutting out chiropractic care under the amendment, so it doesn't eliminate that at all. I think the only provision that's currently in the No-Fault Act would be an independent medical examination, so the auto insurer can challenge using a procedure where they're going to, the consumer would need to go to a visit, an examination by another provider. Short of an independent medical examination, auto insurers don't have the ability to dictate to you that they're going to cut you off or stop the care and treatment just on their own. They have to utilize the system that's in there. I don't consider an independent medical examination medical cost control. It's a more expensive medical legal proceeding that you have to hire an independent physician. The person's got to take the time. My understanding is that there's probably a $1,000 to $2,000 cost at least of an IME, and that's just a poor way to deal with if care is excessive or unnecessary. Every other healthcare system has tools built in, i.e. treatment standards or parameters or fee schedules that recognize their kind of norms of treatment that are accepted. And if you're outside of those norms, there's going to be a challenge to it. So I'm not familiar with more details, Mr. Chairman Davids, about what the carrier utilized. I'm just assuring you there isn't anything else in Chapter 65B other than an independent medical examination. And if somebody cut it off improperly, they shouldn't have.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And another argument I've heard many times over the years on this issue is about how it's driving auto insurance costs way, way up. And members, if you look at what Representative Loon passed out here and you look at the average cost for insurance, we're about 15% below the national average. I have a little experience with this. I just took one of my daughters down. She goes to Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and we got some auto insurance down there, and my gosh, it was way high. It was way out of whack on that. I don't know that they have no fault or not, but so the argument about containing costs, we're 15% lower than the national average right now. I would like to say that the other issue is when I went down underneath my E85 Suburban with my Hard Rock Cafe jacket on, I have to believe that had I gone to the emergency room to the doctor, that the cost would have been much, much more than what I had. I just had a client go into the hospital for just a checkup thing. They got a bill for $7,000, and I went, holy shnikes. I mean, that was a lot of money compared to what my chiropractor charges. So it's hard for me to believe that that would be the case. I would like to say on House File 1395 that I really strongly support Sections 2 and 3. I think Representative Loon is right on the mark here on Sections 2 and 3. Those numbers, it's long overdue that we move that part forward, but I do have, Mr. Chairman, some great concerns about Section 1.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Davids, we were having a side conversation about something else, but I believe that I heard you say because of an E85 vehicle, you had an accident.
Chairman Davis.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
But, Mr. Chairman, if it comes to being a Toyota Prius or my ED5, I'll take my ED5 Suburban any day.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Loon, the bill, quite frankly, seems to now target chiropractic. Is it, and perhaps physical therapists to some degree, but is the point of it that all chiropractors are a problem or just some chiropractors are a problem? What are we... I'll leave it to Representative Loon.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. I don't think every chiropractor is a problem, certainly not. I mean, we all probably know chiropractors, have them in our districts and that. But we are seeing and continue to see some outliers, I think, in the profession. And they're seeking to drive up the cost. Mr. Johnson could probably talk much better than I could about incidences that they're seeing with regards to claims being filed. And so the attempt is to try to bring some kind of cost containment into the system that I don't believe would negatively impact the majority of chiropractors. Now, again, they may have a different view, and that may be, I'm sure that will be the subject of discussions beyond this committee today, one that I hope will bring us to, again, some consensus. But that is my reason for bringing the bill forward.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins, I guess I'd like to make a statement that people may be surprised at, but I've said this publicly, and so I don't have any hesitancy to say it at the podium here. I and we believe a majority, I don't have a percentage on it, a majority of chiropractors in Minnesota are conservative, low-cost providers. How's that for a response from the industry that's supporting this bill? And I believe that's a true statement. So I don't have a number on that, but that reflects our concern and approach to this system, that there are many, many, many chiropractors, frankly, that I believe would fit within today the way chiropractors practice on soft tissue, minor sprains and strains, would fit today within the workers' compensation system. And so I'm sincere in that. I believe that's a true statement, and that's the perspective of the auto insurers on this.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the response, because the delete all, as it currently is written, of course, is a very blunt instrument. It doesn't, Representative Loon, I appreciate your testimony or your impetus for the bill, which was to address the outliers, those that dramatically overtreat to the point where it's unnecessary and just drives up costs. Mr. Johnson then said that the vast majority don't do that. The way the bill is currently drafted, it hits everybody. And I know you're going to, your intent is then to lay the bill over and try to figure out some way to make it a little bit more surgical in its, or targeted in its effort here. But the it is very troubling in the way that it's drafted. As far as cost containment goes, I don't do work comp, but last I checked, I don't think, at least No Fault has a $20,000 max. You can buy more than that, but most folks buy 20. I don't know that work comp, I don't think work comp has a cap. So at least there's a cap. But my thought, and I hope to see if it does move forward, that we all recognize, or at least most people recognize, that those that are dramatically outside normal treatment parameters are the ones in the good chiropractors that I know, and I know a lot of them, would probably say the same thing. That they could likely identify two or three or four chiropractors that dramatically over-treat. But you don't want to, the old baby in the bathwater. So I appreciate the fact that it sounds like you're going to lay the bill over and try to make it a little bit more targeted. I do believe, and I think it's shared by a lot of people, that it will absolutely have health impact. So if Representative Abler or Representative Gottwald want to see it, it's clearly a health issue and ought to go there if those chairs would like to see it. With that, I will keep quiet. Hopefully, we'll see what emerges. I assume, by the way, if you lay it over, it's still going to come back to this committee, so that we can see the working product as it emerges.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Representative Atkins. That is my intent.
Thank you,
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Mr. Johnson, it sounded like you're not that thrilled with No Fault, and I remember that the insurance companies back when Jack Davies carried the bill thought this was the answer to every problem in the world. But I have specific, doesn't this get at not just chiropractors, but also physical therapists? And Mr. Chair, follow. Don't we still have a rule that, we used to have a rule that physical therapists could only treat, I think, up to 3 months without a doctor's indication that the treatment needed to continue. Isn't that still in effect? So that, it's pretty hard to say there's, if that's still in effect, it's pretty hard to say there's any rogue physical therapists doing this, or is that no longer the case?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I know there are physical therapists in the room, and that was my understanding of the law as I last knew it, and I don't know if that's current today. So the limited scope of a practice licensure, but somebody here can...
Well, Representative Mullery.
Mr.
It is.
Chairman, then Mr. Johnson, if that's the case, then it's pretty hard to say that it's just willy-nilly physical therapists running up bills if doctors are saying that it's needed.
Mr. Chairman, but I...
Mr. Johnson.
There's a question. I guess I'd like to respond that I'm not saying, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, that they're willy-nilly running it up. In fact, the data we've been very straightforward with, I've shared with, you know, most of the committee members. There's a closed claim study that has much more detail than these few sheets. And the closed claim data today for No-Fault Auto shows physical therapists on average treating, I think it's 10 or 11 visits. So, again, the work, and in my opinion, what that reflects is that they are today treating within the work comp system, the treatment parameters. So our comment has been, as Representative Luna said, as I'm saying, if you're currently practicing in a way that fits within those treatment parameters, then adopting those treatment parameters in No-Fault Auto is not likely to have much impact on your practice patterns. But without them, and there is an ability to go outside of that. And so given that 70% of all provider dollars in the auto system go to those two groups, 70, and it's growing. Chiropractors get the lion's share, 58%, and physical therapists get 11%, but those are the growth categories. The categories are not growing for hospitals, ER physicians, EMS personnel. They're simply not. So we're looking at the data, and the data clearly shows that's what's happening in No-Fault Auto.
A quick follow-up, Representative Mullery.
Chairman, I guess, do you have anything to indicate that physicians are irresponsible or anything about, I mean, we're talking about physical therapists and limiting them, and yet we have no indication that the doctors are not being responsible, it seems to me. Is there anything to the contrary on that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative
Mullery, Mr. Johnson,
I haven't said anything today about physicians being irresponsible. All I've said is where the dollars today in No-Fault are going, and the majority of dollars, and this is the growth area, is to the treatment of minor sprains and strains, soft tissue. Because that's the category of accident results that's growing in the No-Fault system. You know, with airbags and side airbags and seat belts and speed limits, we're actually decreasing some of the more severe physical injuries of car accidents and fatalities. Those are the categories, the severe injuries where you see this, the severe injuries where you see the dollars go to, you know, the regions, the hospitals, the EMS, and the ER physician, and those are not the growth areas of where No-Fault dollars are going.
Chairman David's a quick question or follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, and maybe I can talk to Mr. Johnson about this later, a couple questions. You said 58% of the dollars go to chiros. I'd like a study or to see a study where what that would have cost had they gone to medical doctors. And I can follow up. I'm not sure how this affects doctors. We're singling out chiros and physical therapists. And I could see something coming down the road where we would pass sections 2 and 3 without 1, because I think we need 2 and 3, but I don't think we need 1. And, you know, I do have to make a disclaimer that I am in the insurance business. I do sell auto insurance. I sell for Norwegian Mutual, where we sell My Fault insurance.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to this bill. I'm just not sure, you know, about the chiropractor part of it. I think the other changes, like Chair Davids has kind of mentioned, I think there's, I'm comfortable with those. You know, as I age, I realize, you know, that I think health has as much, you know, as they say, as much value to me as wealth. And I can just think of my own example. Like the last 3 years, I've probably been to the doctor once or twice. Well, twice, I think. But I've been to the chiropractor probably 10 times. And you just, and believe it or not, I've my chiropractor is Representative Abler. And my first adjustment was back in the retiring room, was from sitting in these chairs. And I don't know, I could barely sit and walk and straighten up. And he was able to, whatever, he's got that little thing and kind of smacked me around. I remember talking to former Governor Plenty about it, and he wasn't sure that I should go to Representative Abler. But
are you trying to get him business or drive people?
I told him nonetheless. He was very good and successful. But, you know, that I think what Representative Davids is saying is that it's far cheaper, and I don't know that you can measure another person's treatment plan, you know, by a clear-cut 12, you know, treatments. And I, you know, with each accident or how you can measure that. I mean, I, you know, hopefully people can be successfully treated quickly. But I just worry that that people aren't able to heal necessarily in that 12 treatment plan. I don't have the numbers, but I can tell you in my own life, like, you know, again, it's kept me healthy by the few adjustments and kept me from surgeries. And I remember a couple of years ago, I could barely walk, and by the end, literally, I had seen Jim Abler twice in 1 week before, and I did a marathon that weekend. So I could barely walk, and in 5 days, I did a marathon. So hats off to...
Sounds good. Sounds like it took less than 12 visits. Chairman Hoppy.
It's a miracle, Mr. Chairman.
I was going to say it sounded biblical. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lilly, I appreciate what you're saying, and I hesitate to say this just in case we're being taped, but I think we put Representative Dr. Abler in that category of good chiropractors, and I appreciate Representative Loon and Mr. Johnson and Mr. Goodnow from the chiropractors all getting together to try to work on something and work this out and protect Representative Abler and the other good chiropractors and try to make this better for all of us, and hopefully we can come back next year and pass something that we're all happy with and satisfied with, and then we can all go upstairs and get adjusted. Then we got to work on getting a psychiatrist around here, and then we're really going to be doing well.
Members, we do have a growing list of questions here, but I'm going to move to testimony from a Kathleen Pickard, who took time off work to be here today to speak, and then we'll do our best to get back to questions. We are running out of time on this issue since we are laying the bill over. We will retain possession and continue this conversation, but Ms. Pickard, if that's her, Pickard? Or
it's Pickard. Pickard. Kathleen Pickard.
Yeah, we want to welcome you to the committee, and thank you for taking time off work to be here and speak with us. So please state your name for the record and proceed.
I'm Kathleen Pickard. I'm a physical therapist representing the Physical Therapy Association. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for letting me testify. This bill is aimed at medical cost containment or cost control, and is aimed at excessive treatment, is what we heard in testimony today. And it's supposedly supported by data, which we have not seen yet. And we're looking at kind of broad categories of providers, and it seems like we're all being treated in a very arbitrary way, depending on whether or not we are those excessive providers or not. We have a few things that we want to just point out in this bill. Looking at lines 126 through 2.5, the definition of soft tissue isn't there. There is no definition other than defined by procedures that are listed in the work comp fee schedule. And as physical therapists, we use those procedures for soft tissue injuries, and we use them for hard tissue injuries as well. So when you look at an auto accident, we do see the general sprains and strains, as they've been called, but not defined. We see those in auto injuries, but we also see other kinds of injuries that have a soft tissue component and that also have other kinds of components. Examples of that might be spinal cord injuries, brain injuries, multiple fractures, and amputations. So the challenge we have is that the bill does not define soft tissue and then doesn't give us any guidance as to what rules we live under for treatment of conditions that aren't soft tissue injuries. So we need to have that clarified. So let me just take you off in a little bit different direction. Under this bill, we are tied to the workers' comp fee schedule and regulations. The regulations, we don't really, the parameters, treatment parameters, are not what we have a problem with, although I think there's some misunderstanding about them. We're told that it's limited to 12 weeks. That isn't entirely true. It limits passive treatment for 12 weeks. Active treatment would be getting people on their feet, moving, exercising, and return to activity. And that is not limited. We prior authorize all of our care under workers' comp through case managers. That isn't the case in the auto industry. And so you see we're applying a set of rules that are designed for workers' injuries to another environment. And let me just say this. It feels as though this is a government regulation of prices. And as a practicing physical therapist in a private practice, it feels as though I can't set my fee that actually expresses the value of my service and the cost of my service in a free market when I am dealing with for-profit private insurance companies. So where the cost, people want cost containment in the service delivery, but no cost containment in the premium. So I'll just point that out. It just feels, just makes me uneasy, and I think that needs to be looked at as well. Lines 2.3 to 2.5 are exemptions. Exempts medical doctors and osteopaths in small hospitals. And we would like this language to include physical therapists as well. Physical therapists are not the target of this bill. We should not be the target of this bill. We are evidence-based. We're conservative, low-cost providers with great outcomes. We have standards of care that have been written by our association. We have the third version of those standards coming out soon. So we've lived within guidelines that we have created ourselves. And the other interesting fact about this bill is that we rely on the workers' comp fee schedule. The fees that were listed by Mr. Johnson were the fees that are paid to chiropractors. And it's a little known fact that under workers' comp, physical therapists are actually paid less for the same procedure codes than chiropractors. So we would be hurt the most by this bill. So having said that, I'd like to just summarize. We'd like to see the soft tissue injury be defined. We'd like to express our concerns again that this is a system designed for workers' comp injuries and not for auto, but we would be subject to that. And we're glad that we heard the motion to lay the bill over so that we can talk over the interim, and we would like to be at the table at those talks as well. And one more clarification, there was a question about our statute for licensure and can we see a patient more than 3 months without a physician referral. It would be 90 days. So that's where it stands. Thanks for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Picard. We really appreciate your testimony. Thank you for coming in today. Kevin Goodenow, Dr. Sawyer, and Dr. Wolf, if you could please come at this time. I'm sorry to make your time so short, but if you could just real briefly address us, we'd appreciate that as we have one more item to get to today.
Mr.
Before
Chairman,
session.
Members of the committee, Dr. Sawyer and Dr. Wolf are not going to testify. We've, with our agreement to lay the bill over and work on it during the interim, we've consolidated our testimony and the intensity will be a little bit lower as well. My name is Kevin Goodenow, and I represent the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. We have about 800 good chiropractors as members of our association, and I'm here representing them today. We have a position against the Section 1 of the bill. We do support Sections 2 and 3, so as Representative Davis mentioned before, it'd really be easy and fly out of here if you just deleted Section 1 now, and we could deal with it. Notwithstanding that, I want to just address a few things, and then I'll open myself up for any questions people may have. There was a comment that was made that we have a failed system with no-fault auto in Minnesota. I think Representative Davis made the comment that we are below the national average on premiums. We actually rank number 28 out of the 51 states and territories, including the District of Columbia. Ironically, number 2, New Jersey, and number 51 on the list, North Dakota, are both no-fault states. So I don't know if no-fault itself is an indication of where you should fall on the premium list. The concern and just another issue is that people have talked about is just the growth of the use of chiropractic within the no-fault system, especially under the personal injury. As Mr. Johnson mentioned before, there's a growing there's reduced number of serious injuries because of the use of airbags and other safety devices in cars. And there's an increase in the number of minor sprains and strains, which typically are taken care of by chiropractors, or a lot of people choose to go to chiropractors for that treatment. Anyway, why do we oppose Section 1 of the bill? First of all, it does, and I appreciate the comments, it does target chiropractic and physical therapists. It's been stated that the bill is targeted at those abusers in the system or the outliers, but the result is any chiropractor and any physical therapist who takes and works on no-fault auto claims is impacted by this bill. It goes beyond treatment parameters and also goes to payment. And then there's also the issue of the interaction with the workers' comp system. Workers' comp system is a return-to-work type of program. It's set up for return-to-work of the workers who are injured. It has a provision that you can get a certain number of treatments during a 12-week period. If you need to go above that, you can go above that 12 weeks with the permission of the insurance company or the commissioner. There's some parameters in there, as we don't know which commissioner we would go to. No-fault auto is governed by commerce, but workers' comp is governed by Department of Labor and Industry. Those are the type of issues that we need to work out. We also have Dr. Sawyer and Dr. Wolf had a large amount of information they'd like to share in refuting a lot of the information that was provided by the insurance industry. Rather than having them come up and testify, I believe Dr. Sawyer would like to put that in the form of a letter and just send it out to committee members so you can look at it at your leisure. I just want to state in wrapping up is that the Minnesota Chiropractic Association is committed to working with the insurance industry, Representative Loon, and other interested persons in coming up with a compromise to deal with treatment parameters and also in working to identify the abusers and outliers within this system. And so we have that, we make that commitment on the record today that during the interim we want to work on that so we can come back next year with a compromise that we can all agree to and move forward and address those abusers and outliers.
Thank you, Mr. Goodnow, and thank you for your commitment to continue the conversation, keep working towards a resolution. Representative Slocum, I have you on the list. You have a brief question or comment. Excellent. Thank you.
Representative Loon, I like Sections 2 and 3, not so much 1. If you've ever walked into a chiropractor's office bent over because you cannot stand up in dire pain and you walk out standing up, it's like fabulous. And you're young, I'm older, I've been there. This needs work.
Representative Dietrich, a quick comment or question, you'll pass. Representative Murdoch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when I first saw this bill, I thought, holy smokes, I'm going to call in sick when we have to deal with it. It's a tough bill. But the changes over the last few days or weeks that Representative Loon has worked on has moved the thing into to the position where I can support the bill. And continuing negotiations will make it even better. So thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll, very quickly, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I would like to just disclose to the committee at large is I've taught Minnesota no-fault insurance for those who are trying to secure their property and casualty license here in the state of Minnesota for the better part of the 1990s. And this is a wonderful law that's in the state of Minnesota. I think that the committee should have a briefing at some time on how Minnesota no-fault works, since we are seeing quite a number of no-fault bills. And the reason that Representative David's injuries were covered is under Minnesota law, it's real clear. If you're in on or relating a motor vehicle that's covered, you've got no fault. And we've got limits inside the policy right now for per person, cumulative in the accident for no fault. We also have limits on wages and other lost services, as well as funeral. It seems reasonable that we would ask the question, why wouldn't we want to look at doing something with the other type of medical on here. This committee has shown a willingness, and this legislature this session has shown a willingness to want to talk about and to move forward with some of those different types of reforms. We have health insurance companies that negotiate with the providers what their rates are going to be. We have the same kinds of things that we would negotiate with dental providers, with other types of providers. This just seems to beg the question when we talk about insurance and looking to try to get the best dollars out of this. So this committee has shown a willingness to do that. I sure hope that as this bill gets laid over that we are able to come to those means of compromise, because I think it's on the horizon. Mr. Chair, those are the extent of my comments.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Chairman Hoppe, and then to Representative Loon for closing comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I want to, I mentioned this earlier, but I wanted to reiterate on behalf of the committee my thanks and our thanks to Mr. Goodnow and Mr. Johnson and Representative Loon and everybody's willingness to get together and work on this in the interim. We look forward to seeing the outcome. We like positive outcomes. We want peace in the valley. And thank you, Representative Loon, and everybody for your willingness to work on this, and we look forward to seeing it next year.
Representative Loon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank the committee members for your excellent questions. I was taking extensive notes from the testifiers on some suggestions, and Mr. Goodnow and Mr. Johnson and I have both had some discussions today. We're already kind of talking about setting out a framework for discussions, so I am very hopeful. Yes, it would be much easier to pass just sections 2 and 3, and for some reason I've decided to not take the easy route on anything I'm doing this session. So I am hopeful, though. I am an optimist, and I think we've got all of the necessary parties involved here and willing to come to the table in the spirit of good faith compromise, and that's where I would like to be as well. So I thank the committee for its time today.
Thank you, Representative Loon. With that, House File 1395 is laid over. Members, on to House File 1394. Chairman Hoppe, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is House File 1394, otherwise known as the Market Assurance Bill. It's a state or a Commerce Department agency bill. We discussed all the amendments and provisions in it yesterday. We laid it over because of the A3 amendment. And in light of the time growing short, why don't we go ahead and jump into discussion of the A3 amendment?
Chairman Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And has Representative Atkins moved the A3 amendment?
It's been moved as of yesterday.
Oh, it's been moved already. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I received a email, I think many of you have, from Twyla Brace, and I've got some questions from that email, if she could come join us possibly for a few questions.
Is Ms. Brace in the room? There she is. If you would please make your way to the testimony table. And Representative Davids, you have the mic.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Ms. Brace, I found some comments in your email somewhat interesting regarding the A3 amendment. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Atkins for putting this forward. I feel very, very strongly that it's something that the state needs to do so that we can control it. And I don't like Obamacare. I think it's just awful. I think it's going to bankrupt the states. I hope Congress, the House, defunds it. I hope the Supreme Court says it's unconstitutional and it goes away. Then this whole issue goes away of exchanges and those types of things. But Ms. Brace would like us to vote no on this, and I'm a very strong yes on the A3 amendment. But Ms. Brace, if we don't do this, what would your backup plan be to take care of this? But first of all, you comment on an attorney, Thomas Christina, a former associate deputy AG under President Reagan and so forth, and she said that it's central to the anti-market project. I don't quite figure that one out. Essential to eradicating private plans when it's actually selling or helping sell private plans. Enforcement without a federal fingerprint, I'm not sure what that means. And nationalization, in fact. We have a very bad law in this country called Obamacare. We either have to come up with the exchanges or they'll be given to us, and I'd much rather that we have the input rather than the federal government. If we don't do this, what would you suggest we do?
Ms. Brace, before you answer, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Representative Davids. I think that what if
would you please introduce yourself for the tape?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No worries.
Twyla Brace. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. So wanting to answer your question, Representative Davids. I think what legislators who are concerned about the federal health care reform law need to do is to not be party to putting it into the state law, and to make sure that the federal infrastructure does not become part of state law, to wait and see exactly what's going to happen with the lawsuits, to make sure, I mean, when Attorney Christina said enforcement without federal fingerprints, what he meant is that the federal, that the exchange would act as the federal, a federal entity within, a federal enforcer within the state, without actually looking like a federal enforcer. But it, all you have to do is actually read the law, and we did a report looking at everything that the law actually says about the exchange, and you realize that the state exchange is a federal exchange. There's really no difference. It's just a patina or of flexibility, you might say, to try to get you to do what President Obama wants to do, because he does not want to put the exchange in. He would prefer for you to do it for him. But then, of course, you will have nothing to say when it takes control over decisions, because it will have been a decision between the state and the administration, the federal administration, to make it happen.
So, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Brace, a couple things here. Three things. First of all, it's the law. It's a really, really bad one, but it's the law. And you said that by doing the, having the state do it rather than the feds do it, that there's no difference. So if there's no difference, what is the difference?
Mr. Chair and Ms. Representative Brace. Davids, the difference is waiting to see what happens with the lawsuits. There are many lawsuits, and so it is to wait to see rather than to implement something that will completely change the market. I would envision that after the market's been changed and millions of dollars have been spent at both the public and the private level, that it would be very difficult to undo once it is actually in. And if you look at Judge Vinson's decision, he wrote that part of the reason that he let he didn't do a full injunction was because several states had moved forward, and it was, he was afraid of disrupting the market, the
Chair
insurance
Davids.
Market.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. And Mr. Chairman, maybe it would be helpful if Mr. Pender could give us a timeline. I don't want to sit around here and wait for the federal government to do something or wait for some court or some lawsuit to be decided. Mr. Pender, what is our timeline on this issue?
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, the federal law provides that the secretary, the federal secretary of Health and Human Services will test each state's readiness on January 1st, 2013. And states have to be reasonably, have to basically convince the secretary that they're making progress and that they'll be fully ready to operate by a year later, January 1st, 2014. And so there may still be some things the states need to fix before 2014, but if it looks to the Secretary of HHS that the state's not going to be ready, then HHS gets ready to come in with a federally run exchange.
Well, thank
Chair
you,
Davids.
Chair Mr. Pender. I don't think we wait on this. I think we get moving on this, and what the A3 amendment, the Atkins language, does is it sets up basically, I don't know if it's a commission or whatever it is, to, you know, set this thing up to see how we want to do it. Then, from what I understand, Representative Atkins, then the report would come back to legislature. We'd have to make a decision at that time as to what we're doing. Would that be correct if Representative Atkins could answer the question?
Representative Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Davids. It gives an opportunity for the working group, the 4 and 4, to come up with a decision by, I believe it was November 1st, and if they fail to do that, then it would default to the Commerce Department to do something so that we don't end up with the feds doing it to us.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I
Chair
certainly
Davis.
Don't see what the harm would be in having a working group look at this thing. This, the Atkins Amendment doesn't even put anything in place other than a group to study this to make sure that we do it right. Members, I would strongly recommend a yes vote on the A3 Amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Brace.
Thank you. One thing I would like to mention Regardless of what you have said, I believe that as soon as you begin the process, you begin the bureaucracy. And one thing I would like to mention to this committee is the fact that there was no public notice about this, which also means that we didn't actually get to see the amendment until, you know, thank you to Representative Hoppe for at least sitting it here in front of me. But there was really no public notice to this. It was just a rumor that I heard that something had happened yesterday. And so this is a very big thing to start a very controversial issue, which is the exchange, which many, many people across the state and across the country are opposed to. And yet there was no public notice of this, so that we couldn't really have anybody to even be here to testify in addition to me.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Davids.
Maybe to Mr. Pender. Mr. Pender, does a study group set into motion a bureaucracy?
Mr. Pender, can you help us with that?
Mr. Chair, I think if the legislature tells a study group that it has the authority to set in place a bureaucracy or whatever you want to call it, my guess is that would probably work. It's unusual, but the legislature's is pretty. Legislation's the law is pretty powerful.
Well, Mr.
Chair Davids.
Mr. Pender, how can we set up a bureaucracy when something is already current law? I mean, current law is already there, the bureaucracy is already there.
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, I'm not sure I know what you mean by the bureaucracy is already there.
Well, Ms. Brace,
Chair Davids.
By doing this, we're creating a bureaucracy, and that somehow makes it that Obamacare is going to happen that's already current law.
Mr. Pender?
Glad I cleared that up for you.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would answer that if the federal law doesn't get repealed and isn't declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, then if we don't create a bureaucracy, the federal government will use its bureaucracy to create an exchange here.
Representative Anderson Diane.
This might be more for Chair Hoppe. I'm on the Health and Human Services Committee, and the state has already been given money to implement drafting of this exchange. Is there some way we can get word from what the department is already doing? They're already, I think, going to be in the process of designing an exchange with the money that they received. Do you know what is currently happening with the department with this issue?
Chairman Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. Which department is that?
Representative Anderson.
I think, isn't it the Department of Human Services was given like $1 million to start implementing an exchange?
Chairman Hoppe?
Designing an exchange.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson and members, we are the Commerce Committee. If we're going to do this, we should do it in the Commerce Department, and this should be an insurance exchange. Shouldn't be done in the Department of Human Services or the Department of Health.
Representative Anderson.
So Mr. Chair and Mr. Hoppe, Representative Hoppe, I think we should find out what the department is doing with the money that they've received, and I'd like to have legislative oversight as to how designing this exchange instead of just having the department using that money and designing it without legislative oversight.
Chairman Hoppe.
Okay.
Chairman Hoppe to the A3.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Atkins and Representative Davids. The truth is that nobody really knows what's going to happen with the new Federal Health Care Act. We don't know what the courts are going to decide. We don't know when they're going to decide it. We don't know what happens in the next election. We could have a Republican president in House and Senate. We could have a Democratic president, House and Senate. Nobody really knows. No one's going to happen with this. No one knows what's going to happen with this legislation. I do think that's something that as a legislature we need to be talking about. I think we need to be proactive. I do think that this is something that we want to make sure that we implement in Minnesota and do it the best way that we can. I am sympathetic to this amendment because I think as the chair of the Commerce Committee and as the Commerce Committee, I think we want to make sure we do this the right way. And I have spoken to Representative Atkins about this. And
at this time, while I do like the amendment, I think we're not going to, I'm going to recommend that we not adopt the A3 amendment and perhaps continue these discussions and find another vehicle for it, or at least continue the discussions.
Chair Davids.
Mr. Chairman, another question for Mr. Pender. What would happen if we don't adopt the A3 amendment, or if it never gets adopted anywhere? What happens?
Mr. Pender?
In your opinion.
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, if we don't do this or do anything similar, then we won't have the state creating its own exchange, and as I said before, unless the federal law is repealed or found to be unconstitutional, and then the federal government will come in here and operate an exchange of its own design beginning in 2014.
Chair Davids.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Pender, what would happen if we don't do it this year?
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, based on the reading of the federal law and the seminars I've been at on the subject and so on, most people that are really experts on this process say that if a state doesn't pass something and get it started in 2012, that it would be difficult for them to meet the deadline of being ready by 2013.
Well, thank you, Mr. Pender.
Chair Davids.
Chairman, you know, I don't like the Obamacare law. I think it bankrupts the state. I think it's just an abomination. But it's the law. It is the law, and we have to prepare for this, and I think we need to have our input as a state legislature instead of having the, you know, all these ifs and buts. I've always said if ifs and buts were candy nuts, we'd all have a Merry Christmas. You know, we have to do something here, and I'm somewhat disappointed that the chair is not supporting the A3 amendment, but we do have to find a vehicle for this. We have to do this. We can't wait around for the courts. We have to get her done.
Mr. Chair, in light of the hour and with our all total understanding that we are the creme de la creme of the House of Representatives and they can't function without all of us, and the fact that we are in session in 8 minutes, maybe we should wrap up this discussion and move on the bill.
At this time, seeing no further discussion on the A3, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. No.
The amendment is not adopted.
Division, please, Mr. Chairman.
Having a division requested, all those in favor, please raise their hands. Thank you. All opposed? Division being requested and all hands being counted, the amendment is not adopted, 9-12.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Atkins.
Are there any other options besides roll calls and divisions? Because we're not having real good luck on either one.
We'll have Mr. Pender research that. Chairman Hoppe, to your bill, House File 1394, as not amended.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that we pass House File 1394 as amended yesterday and move its passage and send it on to the General Register.
With that, all in favor of House File 1394 as amended, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? House File 1394 is passed
as Thank amended. You, Mr. Chair, members.
We are recessed.
Recessed? Are we coming back?
We're adjourned.